This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, my guest is Professor Dorceta Taylor of the University of Michigan. She's the author of an informative new book called The Environment and the People in American Cities, 1600s to 1900s, subtitled Disorder, Inequality, and Social Change. Dorceta Taylor, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks for having me. It's a wonderful afternoon.
It sure is, and delightful to have you here with us. Tell me why you decided to cast a spotlight on the environment and or urban environmentalism, or the environment and the cities. Those are concepts that don't always go together.
Yes, typically they don't, and this is almost an accidental book, because it started out as wanting to write a couple of paragraphs and wanting to look at just people and cities, because most of the environmental history or work that I'd been reading focused on wilderness, forest, very distant landscapes. And in my quest to look for something to fill a few paragraphs, I realized there was this really big gap in our knowledge about how cities are really inform us about environmental thought, environmental activism, and I just wasn't seeing that any place. And after working on those paragraphs for a while, I realized a book needs to be done, and I had better be the one to do it. And so about 6 years later, that's the end of the few paragraphs.
A long couple paragraphs. Why had the issue of the environment been either conceived of or interpreted as being wildlife preservation or outdoorsy?
I think a lot of folks, and I have to include myself in this, in terms of looking at these histories or trying to understand them, really what really comes into play is this notion of going to the unknown, going to these vast places to look for that. And so even though you can find some of these histories, you can find aspects of it in different books or in different places, the role I saw that I could play was to pull it all together in one place, look at it over a long timeline, but to also see the city as a place that was an innovator. So, for instance, if we want to look at things like land use, we see some of the earliest attempts to look at land uses going on in the city. Even something like parks. Central Park was developed, and the Boston Common, or oldest park, 1634, was developed, and people thought about how to use open space a lot earlier than we even start looking at activism around national parks and wilderness. So it's this, when you look at this attempt then to do the basic things that make cities function, clean water, clean air, open space, how to give people access to this, all of this really occurred in the cities before we start to see activists then starting to say we need to think about these things on a larger dimension in rural and remote places.
And Dorceta Taylor, you argue that some of those activists actually piggybacked on the work that was done in the cities, both in their focus and in their tactics.
Yes, yes. They learned from it. And I realized it was kind of short-sighted in our understanding of history to just start with the work that these activists were doing in the countryside and remote places. That's very important work and work that needs to be brought out. But we tended to kind of stop before we understood the context of how important the many of them learned their craft, or many of them copied the craft of the people who figured out how to get it done in the cities. And, you know, once Central Park was built, the John Muir and other activists could use the argumentation that that Olmsted used to get the city, to get cities past the idea that open space was something that civic that governments needed to think about and fund. You know, it's a big argument there. Is it the responsibility of the government to fund parks and open space? By the time we get to Yosemite and Yellowstone, that argument was already won. The question was just now, can we do it in the Western landscape? Can we do it on a national scale? It wasn't if we should do it.
Also, what you point out in the creation of the urban parks, I think classically Central Park in New York City. Dorcita Taylor, you show the people who were taken advantage of, who were removed, who were just expelled from their dwellings. Mm-hmm. This is a part of the history I didn't really know.
Yes, and that's part of where I thought I could be a new kind of voice at looking at some of those inequities. Because quite frequently, and it's very tempting, in looking at this work to focus on the elites or on the big names that we already know, what is often more difficult is to find a narrative that links that with the class inequity and the racial inequity and the gender inequities. And part of what's difficult about that is, you know, blacks in New York left very little written record in some instances. New immigrants just coming off the boats. Many of them did not leave diaries. So it's a lot trickier to understand how they fit into this larger, changing way of looking at environment and cities trying to grapple with how do we get livable spaces for people to live in.
There may be an answer to a riddle that I've been wondering about for a while in your book. The riddle in my head has been, you know, how come the environmental movement traditionally has been so white and so middle class? You make the argument that the white middle class, as it was fleeing the cities, didn't really care about, you know, pollution in the cities, didn't care about the environment as an urban issue, and then took the environmental issue to the wilderness.
Yeah. And with that, we have to be a bit careful because some of the activists did stay in the city. So we had one group of environmental activists who are the ones that are really well known. The men who went out, and many of them were men in the 19th century, who went out and founded many of the early environmental organizations, or went and became leaders of the Park Service, the Forest Service, people like Gifford Pinchot, those kinds of names that we know very well. Many of those were urban elites. Pinchot grew up around, Gramercy Park in New York City, played in Central Park as it was being developed, but became very discontented with the industrial pollution, with the disorder and the mayhem in the cities. And what we find with the group of elites that then went to the west, to the north, into New England, is that they really start to develop a critique of industrialism, which is very important in our founding of environmentalism or modern environmentalism as we know it. But in terms of starting to think about how do we preserve open space on a larger scale, those activists were very important. They really did not spend as much time looking at the grappling with the issues in the city. We then have a group of activists, and what the book is about at its core is this: there's a forgotten work of the group of activists that stayed in the city, the settlement houses, the urban charities, and many of the things they do, some of it we'd probably find rather appalling. For instance, taking poor children from their parents, putting them on trains, and literally shipping them out of the city to the west.
Had a hideous description of one of those train rides.
Yes, yes. And this was very common where these kids that were called orphans, 50% of them were not orphans by any stretch of the imagination, but a rhetoric got developed in the city that these kids are going to grow up to be adults, and if they're not taken care of in the sense of send them to the farms, send them to the West, and the West at the time was really the Midwest, and basically provide free labor for farmers. And the farmers were then supposed to take them to church and give them a wholesome upbringing. And nature, that pastoral nature, was supposed to restore them.
This was very reminiscent of the kidnapping of Native American kids.
Yes, yes. This time, though, it was primarily Irish children, Catholic children that were taken. They didn't take black children or Native American children because these recent immigrant pioneer farmers did not want that in their communities. So they focused really on these Irish kids that were being sent on these trains. And they focused on children because they thought about doing it with adults. And they tried it with older men. And the men just simply got back on the next train, hobo style, and came back to the city. They put pregnant women and children on these trains. And some of them stayed. But when you sent some of these kids were as young as 6 years old. Very hard for them to make their way back to Boston, New York, Philly, Baltimore. And so that dispersal of the poor, the idea, really took hold there. So within the city, these ideas about how to deal with the poor, how to make cities more functional and more equitable as a place to live, really, there are a series of activists who, yes, we can critique some of their actions like that, but we could also look at some of their accomplishments.
Mm-hmm. And I want to also look at some of the early concepts. Mm-hmm. Some of them were quite offensive in some of the groups prior to the settlement houses. I'm speaking with Professor Dorceta Taylor, author of The Environment and the People in American Cities, 1600s to 1900s, Disorder, Inequality, and Social Change is the subtitle. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. The thing that struck me in part of this book, which is an incredible study just of urban America, leaving aside the environment, even though the environment is a focus of it. But if you want to know what happened to urban America from the outset, pick up this book because it explains a lot of things, not only the boom post-Civil War. I didn't know that the growth was 500% from the Civil War to 1900. That's a huge explosion. But what interested me was these concepts that are so reminiscent today of some on the far right, not even that far right, the central part of the Republican Party that blames the poor people for being poor. And this has a long trail here in U.S. history. And actually, it was Hull House and settlement houses that started to correct that largely. Mm-hmm. But talk about that. There was even a distinction between the poor and the pauper, which I thought were identical.
Yes. And that was one of the ideas, the two ideas that really got me through writing this book was really there was a moment when it just kind of became clear to me that this was this notion of the poor and the poor to be blamed for their poverty, how strong it was in both the conception of the city but the conception of nation, and not only how strong it was but how pervasive it was and just how it informed social policy. And that I really did not have a full enough understanding of until I was well into writing the book to really see how much that is. And the next idea was disorder. Because we know that cities in the 18th century and the 19th century, you know, there were riots in cities and we see some of the mayhem. But I didn't fully appreciate how much it informed elite understanding or the understanding of civic leaders, that they felt they needed to control the extent to how people responded to things, interacted with things, and that desire to control behavior, how it drove policy, how it drove how cities conceived of even who gets water, clean water, when do they get it, how do urban services get developed.
Or even the parks. I mean, that parks was part of the system.
Yes, yes. A big driving force behind developing open space, two big ideas. We had some progressives that said we need it because people need a healthy place to be. They're in factories for 18 to 19 hours. Their apartments have no windows, no ventilation. We need a lung in the city. And the park became almost humanized in its metaphor of a breathing space, of a lung. And you need it for people. But the second thing is, and while they're there, Why don't we control what they do? Why don't we observe them? And why don't we use it as the place where we're going to teach basically the American riffraff how to be a civilized cultural group? And it was the only place where people were mixing interracially and less interracially, but more in terms of the working and the middle class, and teach each of these groups to coexist without killing each other.
And there was snobbery certainly on the part of the middle and upper middle class that went to the parks and sneered or looked down upon the exuberance of some people in the working class.
Right, because what goes on there is, again, the lack of understanding the work. By the time we get to the 1850s and 60s, when each city is starting to put in these big parks, these cities were now extremely crowded. So there absolutely was no private space. A typical boarding house in New York City would probably have, a density of maybe 200 to 400 people per square mile, in terms of the density of the cities. But you could have more than 100 people living in probably an apartment building. Now we would not house more than about 10 people in. And so the density was so much, no private space. So the only space now that became available were the cemeteries. And as the cemeteries got too crowded and, they were saying it's inappropriate to really use a cemetery as a play space, the creation of these public parks became the place where the working class could have a breather.
And were they essentially off limits to blacks?
Yes. So the irony of having black communities being many of the spaces where some of these parks were placed, black working class German and Irish communities and mixed race communities, the blacks could not get any work on the park. And in 1857, we had a worse depression than we have now when Central Park was being built. So it was the only work in town. And Germans were able to work there, the Irish, Italians, no blacks were hired to work on that park. And it was a deliberate choice because Frederick Law Olmsted thought if he hired blacks, you'd have a race war. And he didn't want that.
But where could blacks go in New York City then for outdoor recreation?
Many basically stayed in very tight knit black communities in Philadelphia, also in Boston, and their recreation was less outdoor recreation. It was more basically what we now think of a red light district, where you had basically rum bars, parlors, places of where prostitution occurred, shoe shine shops, small establishments, and the church. So the church in those places became black spaces. But there really was no outlet for outdoor recreation till basically, the early 1900s. And as that begins to happen, we get things like the Chicago race riot that occurred for about 4 or 5 days in 1917, occurred when a couple of black kids swam into what was thought to be the white section of the beach, very close to actually where our dear president comes from in Chicago, and that triggers a race riot that goes on forever.
And at what point or did it get possible to have peaceful integration of the parks and the beaches?
Not until the 1960s, because even up until the 1960s, blacks were still beaten or harassed if they went to beaches in Gary, Indiana, in Chicago, even until the 1980s, many cities basically, after the 60s, the civil rights movement, part of it was access to parks. And so some of those beaches were integrated. But what started to happen was integration discrimination kind of went underground. And so many places like there are parks in, say, Dearborn, Michigan, where you needed a residential tag to get in. So it wasn't no blacks allowed anymore. It was just where is your residency sticker or permit. And so that's how the beaches still remain, or the parks, many beaches remained not integrated.
And legend has it that Michael Jordan going to play on some fancy private country clubs in the North Shore of Chicago, too.
Yes. And, you know, it's the same thing that happens with gated communities today, is that there are still completely there are communities that are still racially segregated, and part of that segregation occurs through gated communities that require you to have very strict residential codes, and you have to be recommended by a member, and how, and so you can get around housing laws by having these private kind of enclaves that are established that way.
I'm speaking with Dorcita Taylor. She is the author of The Environment and the People in American Cities, 1600s to 1900s, Disorder, Inequality, and Social Change. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. One issue we haven't touched on really yet about the way you define and describe the struggle for the environment in American cities, that really the struggle for a livable life in American cities, is this question of workplace hazards and workplace activism within the factory and also within the neighborhood surrounding the factory. This goes way back.
And that was another dimension that I really wanted to touch on, was work and work-related issues. Because if there was an area of environmentalism that really should have been paid more attention from the, you know, the flowering of the modern environmental movement, that's the workplace. And there are, and we tended to segment that as a labor issue, a labor organizing issue. And I thought that that really kind of retarded us in terms of how we started to link these issues. And as I started looking back at the cities, I could see the nexus of how they played on each other so profoundly. The same workers that were working in the factories for 18, 18 and a half hours for a pittance were again, the same people who had lacked access to clean water, a livable apartment, open space. So when one looks at early cities, you can't, it's very difficult to separate these issues. And I talk about things like the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, how even within that, some of the early people who we would start to think of as environmental policymakers really tried to respond to what they were seeing in the factories. Some of them ended up with very discriminatory ways of dealing with it. For instance, how instead of looking at something like Fifth Avenue as an area where they wanted to have a very livable community and environment, one of the ways in which the elites working on that thought they could do this was, let's eliminate the factory workers from here. And they did some really innovative things in terms of looking at crowding within the factories, horrible working conditions, and working to improve those. Without their activism, we'd probably be much further behind. However, their anti-class bias also had them think about ways in which, let's remove them from what we want as a genteel neighborhood. So again, that notion of class and how class really created some biases within the environment, we see it playing out in the workplace and some of the horrible conditions that we saw.
And they would do that with zoning.
Yes.
They'd do that with in housing with covenants.
Right.
And other tools that they would use. We've got about 5 minutes left, so I kind of want to bring it forward to today. One issue is the financial crisis, the fiscal crisis of the cities and the counties and the states, whereby there's huge cutbacks now in the parks. And what effect is that going to have?
It's having a huge effect on parks. Their city, Detroit, has sold off several of its park. The city is so financially bankrupt, and other cities are looking at this. And what the city has done is say, we simply can't afford to upkeep these parks. The neighborhoods also in cities like Detroit and other cities that have had tremendous downsizing, both in terms of population, but in terms of its industrial core leaving the city, are saying we don't even have the population to support, to justify having as many parks. So urban parks are really in crisis now. In terms of funding, one option is many cities are feel that they're being forced to look at private funding options. They're building homes, again, some of these gated communities or semi-gated communities built around open space, often is exclusively for the people in those neighborhoods. So we've gone about full circle in about 150 years, having won the fight in the 1850s to make the argument that it is a human right to open space and clean space, and city governments should be the stewards of this open space. We're now coming full circle where these same city governments are abdicating that role and saying, we don't have the funding and we really don't have to provide these parks. And in the poorest of neighborhoods are where the parks are being sold off. And they've gone back to this private model now of saying, let private corporation fund these. And ironically, Central Park led the way in that public-private partnership model. It's been very successful in redeveloping the park. When we look at other cities, though, especially poorer cities that are struggling, they simply cannot raise the funds to do this privately. They don't feel they can raise taxes, you know, for parks. And so they are making that choice to close down or sell off public parks. And it's going on very quietly, and it's really not garnered the kind of public outrage you think it might.
So in a way, though, this is depriving people of their human right to outdoor recreation.
In a way, yes. And I think it will have very significant impact on health. Again, if you're looking at the poorest neighborhoods losing that open space, a space that children can go and play, then and yet we're saying to kids, you need to get up from in front of a television set and go outside. But where is outside? There is no there for the kids to go to. So I think it's one of the issues that we really have to start paying attention to.
And how do we get the people who are impacted the most active on this? I know there's been a lot of work surrounding the issue of environmental racism over the last 20 years. How do we move that forward?
Many of in the cities that are threatening to close the parks or have started to close them have been very surprised, actually, by the community groups that have sprung up to say, oh, no, you don't. And so some of these groups are looking at innovative things like being, if they can purchase some of this land space and keep it in as urban land trusts, so keep it as a public space in perpetuity. So groups are looking at that kind of model. They're looking at forcing the city to keeping these parks open. They're looking at, in some groups in Baltimore, for instance, turned over some of these parks to institutions like churches or community centers, where let the community run the parks. You know, they can come up with activities. They can put urban farms in it. That's another thing that's going on all around the country. So there's some innovative things, but low-income communities, environmental justice organizations are very, very engaged in this. And people really do believe that the parks are for the people and should stay a public entity.
We've got a lot of exciting work going on in Milwaukee with urban farming as well, and I think there's been activism all around. One thing that concerns me, unfortunately, we don't have any time to talk about it, is the demise of Acorn, or the stigmatizing of Acorn, which was doing a lot of the good grassroots work in a lot of these cities on a whole range of issues, from housing all the way on down. But that's going to have to be a conversation for another time. Dorcetta Taylor, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Pleasure's all mine, Dorcetta Taylor, the author of The Environment and the People in American Cities, 1600s to 1900s.
Thanks.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.